This is McGuire on the Wire, brought to you by McGuire Sponsel. We are a national consulting firm aiming to provide facts, advice, and updates on the ever-changing world of tax law. This podcast will give you base-level information as well as high-level thought leadership on how to navigate these technical disciplines. At McGuire Sponsel, we provide unique services to our clients using an old-school, hands-on approach that is deeply respected within the CPA industry. Now stick around and listen to one of our experts. We're glad you're here.
Hi everyone, my name is Tedder Schwarz and I'm a principal here at McGuire Sponsel. I specialize in our IC disc practice and I'm here today to shed some light on a few key topics. Some of these subjects we'll touch on here are what qualifies as a true export, who can own an IC disc, what is the difference between a safe harbor calculation and a transaction by transaction calculation, or what is better known as a T by T calculation, the impact profitability has on an IC disc, and when it actually makes sense to set up an IC disc. So with that, we'll jump right into what is a true export. Essentially, there are three tests to qualify as an export gross receipt. One is the manufacturer test, two is the foreign content test, and three is the destination test. And yes, all three of these have to be passed to qualify as an export gross receipt. So to give a little more detail, one, the manufacturer test. All this states is the export property must be manufactured, produced, grown, or extracted here in the United States. So with that, the labor and factory burden must be at least 20% of the total cost of goods sold. So what they're really trying to get away from is just mere repackaging. They don't want someone to just purchase a product, repackage it, and export it. They want a little more manufacturing to be done. This is a benefit for manufacturers. So two, the foreign content test. It states that no more than 50% of the fair market value of the export property can be attributed to imported content. So this is actually probably one of the most lenient tests the IRS gives us. Essentially, to put an example on it, is if you sell finished product to Canada for $100 and the cost of the imported material in that product is only $49, then you've actually passed that foreign content test. So it's a pretty easy test to pass. The third test, the destination test, the product must be delivered from the U.S. to a purchaser outside of the U.S. And that can be by means of ship, aircraft, or any other kind of delivery vehicle. Along with that destination test, the product must be delivered within 1 year of the purchase of sale. So technically, if you sell it, and you hold on to it for a little while, you still have 1 year to actually export that product for it to still qualify. The other part of the destination test is if you use a freight forwarder or sell to another company, that will still count as your exported product, even though they're doing the exported, as long as it's still done within that 1 year time frame, and assuming that no further manufacturing or no further processing was done within the United States before it was exported. So to give you one aspect or one example of the destination test that would not qualify, say you build something like train cars here in the United States, you manufacture them, build them, and you export them to Canada, but you know for a fact that those train cars are going to be coming back and forth between the United States and Canada. That is something that would not qualify because it's not being consumed in a foreign country. That's something that you know that product is going to come right back to the United States. So that would be an aspect of the destination test that would not qualify. However, if you do not have reasonable knowledge that that product is going to come back to the United States, if you reasonably think that it will be consumed in a foreign country, then that would still count or still qualify for that destination test. So with that, there's another aspect of what qualifies, and that's with regards to direct and indirect exported products. Obviously direct, you're doing all three of those tests yourself. You manufacture it, you're making sure that it was within the means of the foreign content test, and you're exporting it yourself. The indirect method is a little more complicated. So with indirect, the key word is that your product must be attached to something else for it to count as an indirect. So that's a pretty frequent question that we get from our clients. If it's a small component and it's embedded, or if it's incorporated into something, we're on the lines of the gray area of whether it would qualify or not. So moving into our next topic, who can own an IC disk? You know, with this, there's actually a number of different structures and different types of ownerships you can come up with. But the two most common are in the case of pass-through companies or C corporations. With pass-through companies, really the S corp or the LLC itself is generally the shareholder of the IC disk. And right now, this is kind of our bread and butter. With an S corp or an LLC, what you have is when they're the sole shareholder of the IC disk, it makes everything work very smoothly. Because the money doesn't permanently leave the company. With the IC disk, the supplier company, in this case the S corp or the LLC, would make a commission payment to the IC disk, and then since it's the shareholder, the IC disk would turn around and pay the qualified dividend right back to the S corp or the LLC. So that is why it moves and works so smoothly, because the money only leaves the S corp or the LLC for maybe 24 hours, enough time for the bank to actually post that transaction, and then the money comes right back. And right now, that's the easiest setup, and it plays off of the marginal tax rate, obviously a client's marginal tax rate at 39.6 versus the qualified dividend rate. So right now, that arbitrage or that difference is about 16%. So really, we're jumping through some hoops here, but as an end result, we're saving 16% tax on whatever that commission amount is that's transferred to the IC disk and then back to the S corp or the LLC. The other ownership structure that is most common is in the case of a C corp, you generally have an individual that's owning the IC disk or is the shareholder of the IC disk. So it works more like a brother and sister relationship. In this case, The C corp would be the supplier, and the C corp would pay the commission to the IC disk, and then the IC disk would then distribute that qualified dividend to the shareholders, which would be the individuals. So if set up as a brother-sister arrangement, it would be typically the same shareholders as the C corp. Now, the bad thing about that is that the money leaves the operations forever. So the C corp, once it pays that dividend, the qualified dividend distribution, that money stays with the individuals. Now, obviously, they can recapitalize the C corp, but most of the times that money's gone for good. Now, with that said, it doesn't have to be the same shareholders as a C corp. There are many times where we've seen clients actually try and incentivize key employees by being shareholders of the disk. So say you're a CFO and you're not a owner of the C corp, and at the end of the year they want to pay your bonus out of the IC disk, that's one good way to be able to have that key employee benefit from that qualified dividend rate without paying a marginal rate on it. So there are different ways to structure the IC disk and have different individual owners so that different people can benefit. Now with the C corp, again, even though that money leaves for good, essentially what you're creating is a deductible dividend. So the C corp will be able to recognize the commission expense deduction and then and avoid that C corp tax, and then it will go out to the shareholders as a qualified dividend at the qualified dividend rate. So you are creating a deductible dividend with regards to a C corp structure. So the next topic I want to get into is the difference between a safe harbor calculation and a transaction by transaction calculation. And this is another question that commonly gets brought up when we ask people whether or not they're taking advantage of the IC disk. A lot of times they say, oh yeah, we take advantage of that. We just use the 4%. Well, to be honest, there's two different types of simple or what we would call safe harbor calculations. And one is the 4% of export gross receipts on aggregate sales. And the other is 50% of export net income on aggregate sales. Those are the two simple calculation methods, or the safe harbor calculation methods. So in the case of, say, $1 million of export sales, if you're taking 4% of export gross receipts, that's a $40,000 commission. So that is how, as an example, the safe harbor calculation would work. Now, one thing that a lot of people forget about when calculating that is that there is an income limitation. So if your income that's related to your export sales is less than $40,000, you actually can't take a $40,000 commission. Your $40,000 commission on that 4% would actually be limited to the income attributed to your exports. So that's one thing that's left off a lot. But in general, those are the two simple calculation methods. A slight variation of that safe harbor calculation would be to group different sales transactions based on profitability, or various groups like product families. So for some companies that, say, maybe have four or five different product families, they might take that simple calculation or that safe harbor calculation a step further and say, well, on this specific product family, a 4% method works, or on this specific product family, the 50% of export net income works best. And they may try and maximize their commissions a little more using some different groupings. Now, with a transaction by transaction, or like I said before, what we call as a T by T calculation, what we're actually doing is we're taking that 4% of export gross receipts or 50% of export net income on each individual export transaction. So we are actually calculating a commission on each individual sales transaction that was exported during that year. Now, not only does that allow us to maximize that benefit even further, but Treasury regulations also allow you to do some cost allocations. So really, we are allowed to use some various allocations derived from sales detail and move costs away from export sales to make them look even more profitable and therefore maximize those commissions even further. So really, the transaction by transaction or T by T calculation, and along with that extra cost analysis, can really give your IC disk a little more punch and really maximize that benefit. The last point to touch on with transaction by transaction calculation is the no loss rule. Again, this is something that a lot of people bring to our attention, and we field a lot of questions on every year, and that's the no loss rule. People see this no loss rule and say, oh, I'm at a break even year, or I'm at a net loss year. We can't take advantage of the IC disk commission this year. Well, that's not necessarily true. The no loss rules actually apply to each individual transaction. So even if a company is at a break even or a net loss year, if we're doing a transaction by transaction calculation, we can still calculate a commission on each transaction that was actually profitable. So we would essentially throw out the transactions that are break even or net loss and still calculate the commissions on the transactions that are profitable, and therefore can still get or generate a commission on those profitable transactions even in an overall break even or net loss year. So the no loss rule does apply, but it's on individual transactions, not necessarily for a company as a whole. So to move on to our next topic, the impact of a company that has little or no profit, and whether or not the IC disk still makes sense. So this kind of goes off of our last subject there in the no loss rules. The IC disk really plays off of two things. One is the profitability, and two is the amount of export sales or the total export revenue. So it really becomes kind of a balancing act between those two. So companies that maybe aren't necessarily that profitable, if they generate or have substantially more export sales, it may still make sense for them to set up an IC disk. Whereas a company that maybe doesn't have very many export sales and also isn't very profitable, you know, that's when the balancing act kind of falls apart. You're not really balancing anything. We need either a lot of export revenue and lower profitability, or a lot of profitability and lower volume of export sales. So just to throw some numbers into there, if you have, say, $1 million of export sales and your company is fairly profitable, it probably makes sense to set up an IC disk. If your company is pretty stagnant on the profitability, you know, they're kind of a break even every year, then instead of 1 million, it might take 2 or 3 million of export sales for the IC disk to make sense. So really, like I said, it's kind of that balancing act between profitability and total export revenue. Obviously, if you have both a significant amount of revenue and a significant amount of profitability, it definitely makes sense. And that kind of goes into our last topic, is when does it actually make sense to set up an IC disk? And again, our general guideline is right around that $1 million in export sales. When you reach $1 million in export sales, that's when we typically say that the IC disk will more than pay for itself. Again, a lot of that has to do with profitability. So that's why we always say the $1 million number is a guideline. It's not a threshold. So even companies that say might have $700,000-$800,000 of export sales that are really profitable, you know, we've done that before, and it still makes perfectly good sense to run a commission calculation on them. That will be something to keep in mind, and we will discuss that as that comes to be. So thank you for your time today.
Thanks so much for listening to McGuire on the Wire. Have a question from today's episode or interested in our team covering another topic? Reach out to us at McGuireOnTheWire@McGuireSponsel.com.